Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mahatma Gandhi famously struggled for India. He also struggled with India, says my guest today, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Joseph Lelieveld. Lelieveld's new biography follows Gandhi from his years in South Africa to India and the heart of Indian struggles over caste, religion, and independence. Some of his reporting is raising a hullabaloo in India right now. This hour on Point, the man who stood and stands for nonviolent struggle, Mahatma Gandhi. You can join the conversation. Does a man need to be perfect to be a Mahatma, a great soul? Have you seen the headlines shouting off of Lelieveld's book on bisexuality, on racism? Did you see the imprint of Gandhi in Tunisia, in Egypt, just this year? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joseph Lelieveld joins us in just a moment. Let's hear the sound, the voice of Mahatma Gandhi first. This is tape from a visit he made to London in 1931, recorded by the BBC in Kingsley Hall. The title of his talk was My Spiritual Message, and here he speaks about God and goodness. This is Mahatma Gandhi.
That informing power of spirit is God, and since nothing else that I see merely through the senses can or will persist, he alone is. And is this power benevolent or malevolent? I see it as purely benevolent, for I can see that in the midst of death, life persists. In the midst of untruth, truth persists. In the midst of darkness, light persists. Hence I gather that God is life, truth, light. He is love. He is the supreme good.
The voice of Mohandas K. Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, 1931, in London. Joining me now from New York is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Joseph Lelieveld. He worked for the New York Times for nearly 40 years as a correspondent in South Africa and India, as executive editor from 1994 to 2001. In 1986, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his book on apartheid titled Move Your Shadow. His new book is Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. Joseph Lelieveld. Joe Lelieveld, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Glad to be here, Tom. Thank you.
My goodness, your book is kicking up quite the response. The headlines coming out of it about bisexuality and racism and right on down. I'm reading here stories just coming out today in Maharashtra, in India, talking about banning the book. We will get to all that, and very much so. But tell us, Joe, what were you setting out to tell the world about Mahatma Gandhi with your new biography? So many books written on him. One of the best-known figures in the world, surely. What were you setting out to reveal, explore?
Well, this book goes back to my time as a correspondent in South Africa and India, the motive for the book. There were questions about Gandhi that just stuck in my mind all these years. And one of them was, why when I got to India, I first worked in South Africa, why when I got to India, all the people who were in politics, who professed to be his followers, had such different preoccupations and values from the values that he espoused. And I became interested in seeing how his emphasis on social equality emerged from his South African experience, which lasted 21 years, a full third of his adult life, and how when he came back and made the great impression that he made on India, he tried to move India on a variety of fronts related to social equality, equality between Hindus and Muslims, between caste Hindus and untouchables, and so on, and to try to uplift the mass poverty of the villages, he made relatively little impact on an obdurate India in that area. India revered him, but it didn't necessarily follow him. And as his life wore on, he became aware of that, most tragically in a way, at the time of partition, when the Muslims and Hindus, whom he thought should be united for a social transformation in India, started slaughtering one another And there's a moment that sticks in my mind as a real nadir for Gandhi, a really painful moment, when he goes to the Indian state of Bihar, a very poor state,
yes.
Where Hindus have been killing Muslims on a mass scale for some months by the time he gets there.
And some of them, you write, shouting his name as they did it.
That's exactly where I was going, Tom. Mm. They shout Mahatma Gandhi Ki Jai, which means glory to Mahatma Gandhi. And he says, those Jai shouts stink in my nostrils. It's sort of the... Mm-hmm.
I hate to hear them, he said. Hindus massacred innocent men and women, just as Muslims kill Hindus shouting Allahu Akbar. He didn't want to hear his name, didn't want to hear that jai, that glory associated with that.
Associated with killing and communal enmity, both of which were the antithesis of what he stood for.
Now, the world knows him as Mahatma Gandhi, and of course Mahatma meaning great soul. You've taken that as the title of your book, and yet you've got a lot in here that goes at Gandhi's foibles, his peculiarities. This was not a kind of cookie-cutter guy by any stretch of the imagination. And I ended up wondering exactly where you come at Mohandas K. Gandhi from, Mahatma Gandhi from. Do you in fact see him as a great soul? Or is there an element of cynicism in your use of that phrase as your title, Joe?
No, I think I used it to indicate that my basic feeling is admiration. And on the last couple of pages, I sum up what I think are the reasons for that feeling. I'm impressed by his moral ambition. I am impressed by his 50-year commitment to the poorest people in the country, and his persistence. By the time he's walking around barefooted in what is now Bangladesh, trying to tamp down the communal frenzy that's going on. He's one of the most famous people in the world. He's been an international celebrity for decades. He could easily have resided in the mansion of one of his rich sponsors in Bombay or Delhi, and issued moral statements from that remote place. Instead, he separates himself from that milieu and goes to the most difficult, strife-torn parts of the country, all by himself, with a small entourage, and puts his life on the line. He knows he's putting his life on the line. In fact, he starts anticipating his eventual assassination at about that time, because everything he does to protect Muslims enrages Hindu supremacists, and everything he does to protect Hindus in areas where they're a minority enrages Islamic extremists. But that's Gandhi, and I find him. I can't think of another figure who never held political office, who was so true to his commitments and so engaged in a process of moral I don't know what to say. I don't want to say moral rearmament, but moral energizing of himself and his country.
A kind of permanent pilgrim, and of course ultimately assassinated by a Hindu, maybe of that supremacist persuasion. Born in 1869, we have to remind ourselves just how far back Gandhi went. His name still can seem very fresh in these days of Tahrir Square in Tunisia and, of course, revived in the civil rights movement and all the rest. Revered as the father of India today in contemporary India. But you title the book is Struggle with India, not for India. Why with?
Because on these fronts, I mean, he struggled for India, and in the sense that India became independent and free of British rule, colonial rule, Gandhi is the major figure in that struggle. Not the only one, but the one who rightly stands out in the imagination of Indians and in Indian history. But he also struggled with India for values of social equality and harmonious living and simple living, and for with an eye on what was going on in the villages. He said India would be free when the lame begin to walk and the dumb begin to speak. By that standard, in India, to some considerable degree, is not free today.
And of course, the great avatar nearly of nonviolence, the country left behind, ultimately itself becoming a nuclear armed country. It's hard to imagine how Mohandas K. Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, might have thought of that, but maybe not so hard.
He spoke about it. He lived past Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and he said, "I pray to God that that we will not be take. I can't remember the exact words, but we will not take up what he called this atom bomb mentality." And 27 years after he made that statement, India exploded its first nuclear device.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, and the rich, complicated life behind the global symbol of nonviolent struggle. Joseph Lelieveld is with us. His new book is Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. Here's a little more of the sound of his voice. Again, 1931. This is an address in Geneva, Switzerland, in which he discussed India's independence struggle and his resistance to violence.
I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace. I know the value of discipline and truth. I must ask you to believe me when I say that I have never made a statement of this description, that the masses of India, if it became necessary, would resort to violence.
His influence soon all over the world. Martin Luther King often cited Gandhi as an inspiration for nonviolent resistance. In Montgomery, Alabama, in October 1957, King was interviewed for the NBC television program Look Here.
But I remembered hearing a message by the president of Howard University, Dr. Mordecai Johnson, who had just returned from India. He spoke in Philadelphia on his trip to India and the whole philosophy of Gandhi and passive and nonviolent resistance. Now, I was so deeply moved by the message that I went away and bought several books on the Gandhian, on Gandhi and Gandhian technique. And at that point, I became deeply influenced by Gandhi.
Martin Luther King, 1957. Joseph Lelieveld joins us from New York. His new book is Great Soul. Joe, I wish you'd take us back to that enormous piece of Gandhi's life that was in South Africa, not in India. He was a London-trained barrister, a lawyer, spent many years in South Africa. You know, where did the man we ultimately came to know as Mahatma Gandhi come from? What was it about his experience in South Africa that began to shape this man?
Well, he arrives there with a notion that the small Indian community, at that time only about 100,000 people, many of them indentured laborers under contracts of servitude on the sugar plantations and coal mines, that the at least the non-indentured Indians had the rights of what he called British Indians, meaning as citizens of Queen Victoria's empire. They should have equal rights with whites. And that was not the sentiment of South Africa's whites, as the world came to know. Mm-hmm. And he at first pressed that argument. We're all citizens of the empire. He wasn't striving for equal rights for non-Indians and non-whites, specifically Africans, but he was striving for the rights of middle-class Indians. That's where he begins. He's in his early 20s at that point. Then a number of things happen, but one of the most interesting, and I think perhaps pivotal, is an editorial in a Johannesburg newspaper responding to one of Gandhi's first political writings. And the editorial writer, obviously a Brit, an English white, says, what's this about giving equality to Indians? They don't give equality to each other.
And in their own caste system in India.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And Gandhi, for Gandhi, that's an epiphany. And from that moment on, really, he starts talking about high and low, that the whites here treat us as untouchables because we treat our own people as untouchables. And that metaphor becomes central to the development of his social thought over many years. He, for a short time, or for not such a short time, becomes a prosperous lawyer for a time. He's the only, in the beginning, the only Indian lawyer in the country. And he becomes quite well-to-do. But as he goes on reading more deeply, he reads Tolstoy is a profound influence on him. This is the Tolstoy who becomes a kind of radical Christian prophet at the end of his life. Gandhi begins to simplify his life, and first he establishes a sort of commune called the Phoenix Settlement, and then he establishes another one he calls Tolstoy Farm, through a series of circumstances comes to his philosophy of satyagraha, which is firmness in truth is perhaps the best translation.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that emerges his version of passive resistance, which was not just passive. Gandhi's passive resistance was a kind of passive-aggressive resistance. He believed in struggle. He believed in confrontation with the authorities. He would have been very pleased by what we've seen in Tunis and Cairo. Less pleased, of course, by the crowds in Tripoli breaking into armories. He believed that the resistors should face the armed oppressors and allow themselves to be beaten and shot until the oppressors themselves see the evil of their ways.
He didn't come to that all at once. He's famous for nonviolence, but you report three times he volunteered for military service.
As a non-combatant, the third time, actually, he would have been a combatant if anybody had taken it seriously. He was 50 years old.
World War One, yeah.
Yeah, but in the Boer War, he led a detachment of Indian stretcher bearers, and they were called body snatchers by the British troops for some months while the war was still being fought over in Natal. And in 1906, there was a very important episode when he tries to repeat that with raising a body of stretcher bearers to on the side of the whites who are repressing what they characterize as a Zulu rebellion. Basically, it's a kind of outbreak of white hysteria. And Gandhi later came to feel he was on the wrong side. He saw a lot of brutality in that campaign. He came in at the end of it when they were really beating up on poor rural Zulus who hadn't done anything in a violent way. And Gandhi's stretcher bearers became the sort of first aid corps for these prisoners, and I think that led very directly to his first proclamation of nonviolence in 1906, and which is almost simultaneous with his decision at the age of 37. And having fathered four sons, to take a private vow of celibacy.
That gets into territory all its own. A couple of the things that are got headlines popping all over the world, including some outrage in India about your book, Joe Lelieveld. British Daily Mail, you know, is reporting off of your book that Gandhi left his wife to live with a male lover, a German-Jewish bodybuilder in South Africa. The Telegraph says that, again, reading you, that Gandhi held racist views against South African blacks. What about those, Joe?
Well, my book appears in the stores for the first time today. None of the people who are writing these articles about what's in my book, who were writing those articles yesterday, have seen the book.
I wouldn't say none of them. Reviewers are people who have read and reviewed the book are picking up some of the same themes.
Well, the language, racist, bisexual, and so forth, were in a review, that's true, by a right-wing British writer named Andrew Roberts that appeared in the Wall Street Journal last weekend. He was rather gentle with the book itself, but he trashed Gandhi.
Boy, did he. He said, you give readers more than enough information to discern that he was a sexual weirdo, a political incompetent, a fanatical faddist. Why?
Well, I can't argue with the conclusions people draw, but they're not the conclusions I drew. His relationship with Hermann Kallenbach, this Jewish architect from East Prussia who was living in Johannesburg, is one of the most important relationships in his life and perhaps the most intimate. But by intimate, I do not mean sexual. They lived together for nearly 4 years in Johannesburg while Gandhi's wife was living in Natal, in those days a day's trip away by rail, and Gandhi became very dependent on Kallenbach's company and implored him to come with him to India. And in fact, when Gandhi finally left South Africa in 1914, Kallenbach did come with him. He never got to India, but that's another story. They were very preoccupied with all sorts of diet issues and nature cures and physical fitness things. And there's a correspondence that has survived, a one-way correspondence. Gandhi's letters to Kallenbach have survived and are in the National Indian Archive and were published in a volume of Gandhi's collected works in 1994, and they're there for anyone to read.
Everyone's quoting you from those saying, Kallenbach, or Gandhi writing to Kallenbach, how completely you've taken possession of my body. This is slavery with a vengeance. Is this part of the ascetic life?
Well, this is Gandhi, but Gandhi is a man who underwent massage. There's a kind of sybaritic side to Gandhi's ascetic life. He cared very well for his body. He paid immense attention to diet, taking long walks, to bathing, enemas, massage. I think all of that was important between him and Kallenbach. But one of the things they were trying to do with diet was to suppress physical desire. And they tended to believe that milk and meat and a variety of other things were aphrodisiac. For a time, they were eating only one meal a day. For a time, they were fruitarians, not even eating vegetables. And they were constantly experimenting. Gandhi, obviously, is the lead experimenter, to try to find a balance in their lives where the great demon of sex would not preoccupy them. I take that as the core of their relationship, and I would not use the word bisexual, and did not. Now, for the race matter, I have a whole chapter on Gandhi's views and relations, or more particularly, non-relations with Africans in the time he was in South Africa. I think he understood very well that ultimately the struggle in South Africa would be between white nationalism and black nationalism, and his choice was to keep Indians out of it so far as he could.
Joe Lillivelt writes, our various Gandhis tend to be replicas fenced off from our surroundings. In his times, the original, he writes, with all his quirkiness, elusiveness, and genius for reinvention, his occasional cruelty and deep humanity will always be worth pursuing. Joe, let me begin, if I may, to turn to our listeners. Many have been calling and waiting to join the conversation with you. Let's get Erfan in Boston. Erfan, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Tom, peace be upon you, Joseph. How are you doing, guys?
Very well, thank you.
Hi.
My basically comment was, I was born and raised in India, and you are taught in schools basically the great ideals of Gandhi. And when I turned about 21, right now I'm 28, and I'm Muslim Indian, so I had to find out how great of a man he is. And after reading his own book, My Truth With, My Practicals with Truth, or My Experiment with Truth, and I read it actually in my own native language, which is Hindi. And it turns out he was as human being as Joseph is explaining. He tried his whole life different experimentation with race, different businesses, and he actually tried. And I was actually shocked to learn that he was invited to South Africa by wealthy Muslim Indians. And that has never been taught in Indian culture.
Well, in fact, the first political speeches of his life were given in mosques. He became the secretary of the first political organization put together by Indians in South Africa, called the Natal Indian Congress, which was led principally by Muslim merchants.
And Muslims helped him rise to prominence in India, you report, Joe.
That's right. There was a movement at the end of the First World War to preserve the Caliph of Constantinople, the Ottoman Emperor, as the keeper of the Muslim holy places. And that became an obsession, a central cause for Indian Muslims. And guess who was the principal mover of this effort to preserve the caliphate in Constantinople? It was the Hindu lawyer from Gujarat, Gandhi.
Irfan, how have you come ultimately to look at Gandhi? A great soul or something else?
I feel like he's a great soul. He's as human being as you and I, Tom, because basically he made mistakes, and he admitted to that, that I have made this mistake. Like, for example, he said about India, that the trials and tribulations and success of India depends on unity between Hindu and Muslim.
Yes.
And if you could see history, every 10 to 15 years, politicians are using the religious
divide.
The comments to incite and insult people. But I definitely feel like if people educate themselves in India itself, like, for example, like if you go to his ashram in India, Gujarat, it's completely abandoned. Like, people show up, the politicians show up twice a year, and just to show that they have respect for Gandhi. But if you go in Indian politics, there is nothing like a Gandhi values. It's just good. It looks good on papers. It looks good on its statues with flowers, but it doesn't look good in practicals.
Irfan, I really appreciate your call. Joe?
When Gandhi died, when Gandhi was murdered, he was mourned in both Pakistan and in India, and that murder was so shocking to the society that it basically put an end to the communal killings that had been going on for a year and a half up to that point.
A little music behind us right now from a 2006 Bollywood film bringing the Gandhi story back once again to the youth in India. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, and the rich, complicated life behind the global symbol of nonviolent struggle. Joseph Lelieveld is with us, Pulitzer Prize winner, longtime reporter for the New York Times, executive editor there until 2001. His new book is Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. You can read an excerpt of Great Soul at our website, onpointradio.org. It has a kind of hullabaloo going on in India right now, even before it's released there, on headlines coming out about Gandhi's private life and views, but it gives us a deep review of that life and its successes and its failures. So we've got a lot of response online. Greg says the problem here is that too many people worship persons rather than ideas. Shiva writes, he, Gandhi, is no god. He lived a life just like you and me. What makes him a Mahatma, great soul, is he was true to himself, true to his thoughts. From this perspective, Shiva writes, I believe we can understand his failures and foibles. He's more spiritual than political. Let me get a call right here from Keyseltown, Virginia. Anne, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about Gandhi's nonviolent stance. Mm-hmm. I'm a person who believes that violence is never necessary and never right. And I always really held on to Gandhi as a person who believed that. And I was on the internet, and I was reading something by Nelson Mandela. It was either a speech or a short mm-hmm. piece that he wrote. And I wish I could remember better. He quotes Gandhi as saying that violence was sometimes necessary, and that really shook me up. I wish I could remember the quote better. It was something like he would prefer that a person use violence with honor than be a coward without. And be nonviolent.
And I think that's quite enough for us to get the idea. And let us take it to Joe. Joe, what about was Gandhi an absolutist on nonviolence? Do you know the reference that Anne's referring to?
There are several passages like that in Gandhi where he says if the choice is between being passive in and suffering oppression and resisting, he would prefer, and he strongly advocated, nonviolent resistance. But if nonviolent resistance, he believed, was basically more difficult than violent resistance. And if the person wasn't strong enough to resist nonviolently, then he thought violent resistance was preferable to simply suffering. That's a theoretical position. It's not a position he ever really carried over into his political life. I think he was pretty consistent with his values, and to some considerable degree, despite the messy, bloody denouement of the Indian independence struggle mm-hmm. with partition and killing, to some considerable degree, the nonviolent mobilization of the Indian national movement had everything to do with the retreat of British power.
Let me get another question on this front, if I may. Ellie is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Ellie, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My question is, if I'm not mistaken, Gandhi published an article in the 30s advising the Jews in Germany to act the same way he was acting and regarding non-violence. So I was wondering what your author has to say about that and when things turned out not the way we all know how it ended. What was Gandhi's reaction to that? And my second question is, what would be the outcome if Gandhi was facing not the British Empire, but Russia or other ways of dictatorship?
A different imperial master, potentially. Let's go to the first, and thank you, Ellie. Joe Lilleville, how about it? Mahatma Gandhi on Hitler, on the Holocaust, on the Jews, his advice there. What's the record?
Well, the record is that he made some – I don't think it was an article. I think he made some stray comments. People would come to him in the 30s and ask his opinions on world affairs, and he would speak carelessly at times. And he did say that if the Jews would only face the stormtroopers and allow them to do their worst, their own violence would melt the hearts of the Gestapo.
I mean, face them nonviolently,
yep.
And let the war.
Right,
my goodness, yeah.
And that was very effectively answered by Martin Buber in a letter to Gandhi that I don't think Gandhi ever received. but that survives, in which he said that he had seen Jews face Nazis nonviolently, and the result were forgotten deaths. And I don't remember the exact quote. Buber's more eloquent than I can be, but he writes out of great respect for Gandhi. Gandhi did not fully understand the difference between the totalitarian movements in Europe and what he had faced in South Africa and India. And in fact, at one point, he drew a comparison between Hitler was doing to the Jews and what the English of Natal had done to the Zulus in that rebellion we discussed earlier. It's, of course, an absurd comparison. Now, what did he ultimately say about the Holocaust? I don't think he said very much. Of course, the term Holocaust wasn't in use in his lifetime. I don't know how much he took in after the war about what was being learned about what had actually happened in the camps. I'm uncertain about that.
And what about Ellie's question on, I mean, it's counterfactual here, but if India had had a different imperial overlord, not the rather relatively liberal-minded, you know, United Kingdom, British Empire, but, I don't know, you take your pick. There's a whole thread out there that's risen in response most recently to your book, Joe, saying, oh, you know, India would have had its independence anyway. Gandhi didn't really matter. And he's lucky he had the British because they were sort of leaning that way morally in any case.
Well, I think India would have had its independence. It's a little hard to imagine a Britain shattered by World War II maintaining colonial rule in India throughout the 50s. That is true. But that doesn't negate the fact that Gandhi was at the center of the movement against British rule. I first faced that question in South Africa. On my first visit to the Phoenix settlement, the old Gandhi commune, when talking to Indians who had come up against the apartheid machinery of the Afrikaner nationalists, none of them still believed in nonviolent resistance at that point because they said this government is simply too ruthless. It won't work here anymore. And in fact, it's arguable that it never really worked there. So Gandhi himself had some reservations about how to use his nonviolent tactics. He only called for national nonviolent campaigns several times in his 33 years back in India, basically because they tended to end in violence. Once the leaders of the movement were arrested, the followers didn't necessarily maintain the discipline that Gandhi thought was essential for effective nonviolent action.
Talk about the private life as he went deeper into his own life, watching, observing his own successes and his own failures. I mean, there was the funny thing that you point out. I've been at that ashram in Ahmedabad where, I guess other places as well, Gandhi taught, you know, clean up after yourself, you know, clean your own toilets. And you report that today the people there do that once a year in honor of Gandhi on his birthday. And then the peculiarity of his personal arrangements as he went on in life. I mean, his sleeping with his young niece, I don't know, 17 years old or something, when he was in his late 70s. What was that about?
Well, Gandhi, I'm not very good at unraveling spiritual inclinations because I'm not a very religious person myself. I'm not a religious person at all, I suppose. But Gandhi came to believe at some level of his being that his self-discipline and his being true to his values had everything to do with the outcome of the struggles in which he was engaged. And so if Hindus were slaughtering Muslims and Muslims were slaughtering Hindus, it was some failure in him. That was the way he experienced it. I don't know that he thought that intellectually, but he felt that at a deeply emotional level. If he had been a better man, more of a Mahatma, more pure, more true to his supposed Mahatmaship, which he tended to belittle, and then things might have turned out differently, might still turn out differently.
Mm-hmm.
So he had this bizarre compulsion at the end of his life to test his vow of celibacy, under which he had been living now for decades, by sleeping naked with young women in his entourage.
That's and a test, all right.
And he did this sort of publicly. Gandhi didn't have a private bedroom. He tended to sleep outdoors on verandas with other people around him. It was known. And then he started speaking about it publicly, which really distressed the movement, because even if you can stretch your mind to understanding what was driving him,
a kind of discipline or the effort of discipline,
it wasn't good politically to be talking about this at this moment. And people, some of his closest associates with him came to him and would argue with him about it. But he was quite stubborn. And he gave it up for a little bit when the young woman, his niece, grandniece, said maybe we shouldn't go on with this, but he persisted, and there are those who were close at hand who watched it, who believed that he somehow gained strength and focus and fortitude from this experience. It's not something that I, as a secular Westerner, can well understand or explain, but it happened. And so I try to describe as accurately as I can how it unfolded and what the results were.
Yeah, he made his own way. Certainly the legacy that he left behind was not focused on that. It was focused on this great message. Kind of incredible that one man could lift such a message of nonviolence in a century that was so incredibly violent. Joseph Lelyveld is with us. His new book is Great Soul on Mahatma Gandhi. Let's get a call from Gita in Arlington, Massachusetts. Gita, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having a whole program on Gandhiji, and it's very rare, and also Professor Lelyveld for writing about Gandhiji and bringing him into the focus, because currently I think we'll have to have another show on Gandhi because it's getting sidetracked by his personal life. Right now what's happening in Libya and President Obama ordering the no-fly zone,
yes,
etc., and taking action is very significant, and he's one president who even mentioned Gandhi,
Yes, he has.
So the fact that he's taken a lot of thought into taking this decision, he's faced a lot of criticism from even people who've really supported him. It would be great to see how Gandhi's message of peace and fighting against injustice would be relevant today for Americans who are taking action in Libya and how it could help Libyans.
Gita, I'm very happy for your call. Joe Lelyveld, our time grows short, and indeed, it's the big message that resonates most powerfully all around the world. His very name has come to stand for this idea of peace, of nonviolence. How do you look at that? He had his failures. You point to them. He couldn't solve the Hindu-Muslim conflict. Wow, okay. He couldn't solve the caste issues in India.
Of course, it would have been a miracle if he had.
Of course, it would have. Nevertheless, he left this legacy, aspirational, inspirational. How do you look at that today? Is it lasting? How great that legacy? And do you see it alive in, I don't know, in Barack Obama's view of the world today, in the Middle East uprisings today?
Well, I'm not sure that the people in Cairo and Tunis were really thinking about Gandhi, but
yet they had a notion of nonviolence that was at work.
That's correct. And you don't have to give Gandhi ownership of their movement to understand that his example has been handed on from one culture to the next. Over the decades is part of the story there. I'm looking at Gandhi principally as a social reformer in this book, and so I dwell less on the legacy for nonviolent struggle and peace movements. I dwell on social inequality and his efforts to make some dent there.
India is still saddled deeply with inequalities.
Exactly. And I end up by saying that insofar as India has a social conscience, and I think it does, that social conscience can be described as Gandhian. And I think people in India whom I've met who struggle in those causes think of Gandhi as an inspiration. And I think that's his deepest relevance in India today. In the world at large, the example of nonviolent struggle is probably more central.
We all need our symbols. Surely, certainly, he's one. Joseph Lilienfeld tells the story in great depth and detail in his new book, Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Joe Lilienfeld, great to have you back with us today. Thank you for your time. Thank you for the book. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Tom. Thank you.
We'll go out with a bhajan, a kind of hymn that Gandhi and his followers sang as they walked on the great famous Salt March to the Sea, 1930. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point. Thank you.